Okay, we're beginning here with the Mishnah on the top of Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph. Hashochet et ha-bechor. Someone checks the bechor. Vinoda shelo her'ahu. And then they find out afterwards that it wasn't shown to a chacham, it wasn't certified. Masha achlu, achlu. Whatever they've already eaten from the bechor, they've eaten. V'yachzir lehem adamim. And the person that sold it to them now has to reimburse them for that which they ate. So the bechor, generally, as we've seen before, requires a mum to be shechted. And the assumption here, too, is that there may be a mum in it, or it's possible that there was no mum in it at all. The Kohen has the right to use this animal for whatever purposes he chooses, including selling it to other people, having others eat it. We saw in the Mishnah before that even Yisraelim can partake in a bechor. So here he sold it off, whether it's to Kohanim, Yisraelim, to eat it, but he forgot to inform them. And forgot is maybe a generous word over here, to tell them that it was a tam, or he forgot to tell them that he never got it certified by a chacham, that the mum here is a valid mum, and we saw from Rabbi Meir before, if you shecht on a mum, and you don't get it certified, after the fact you can't do anything about it, it's a knas, and it's a surba hanah. Over here, they ate from the animal, and they did get hana from it. We know that in the Gemara Baba Kama, even in instances where an animal is patur mishein from eating and doing nezek, nevertheless, the animal benefited from the food and the nutrition that it got, and then you don't have to feed it at home. So you might not be chayav for the nezek it did, but you are chayav, or you are responsible for the hana'ah that it got benefit from. Similarly over here, you ate a good steak, you had a meal here, maybe you should have to at least pay for that hana'ah, or compensate from that hana'ah. Over here, the Mishnah says, "Ve'yachzir lehem adamim." Even that which they ate, he has to refund them the money. Rashi over here says, "Mishum knas." It's a penalty on him. The isur, the way we have it in the Girsa is very difficult. If you look it through the Shittim Megubetz, it is the isur safi that he gave them isur. It's a knas because he fed them isur. We're penalizing and saying, even though their motive is hana here, and even though they should deduct that amount from the reimbursement. Nevertheless, the Chamei penalized him because he did something wrong. He fed them Yisur, and therefore we want to penalize him. Later on in the Gemara, there is an alternative way to view that, and Rashi in the Gemara explains that, and you could explain that in the Mishnah here as well, which is maybe there is no Hana'ah over here. Because when the person's informed about the fact that they ate non-kosher items, they're not going to feel good about it. They're going to feel terrible about it. And maybe that's enough to wipe out the value that's there. We'll discuss that when we get there. But then for that reason, he has to compensate over here. U'mashu lo achlo, whatever they didn't eat, abasar yikaver, then that gets buried because it's asur ba'ana'a. Zilehem et adamim, he has to give them back the money. There he clearly has to reimburse because they don't get anything for it. And it's asur ba'ana'a, that he has to reimburse. V'chein, and similarly, shuchet et apara, person who shechs apara u'machara. And then he sold it. And then they find out it's a trefa. Again, seems like the individual didn't do this accidentally. Sounds like the individual did this intentionally. The nafkamina might be between the two reasons that we gave before. If it is a kanas, then it would only be true generally when you do it b'mezid, if you did it intentionally. If you did it by accident or unintentionally, then you may not have a kanas to reimburse in this incident. On the other hand, if you believe that the problem here is that the people aren't getting hana because they ate non-kosher food, and therefore they don't have to pay you for that hana because it doesn't exist, that would apply whether you did it intentionally or unintentionally. So that might be a nafkamina between the two reasons. But over here, where you have the trefa, masha achlu achlu, whatever they ate, they ate. There are some girsaot of the Mishnah that have the v'yachzilem et adamim here. Even if it doesn't have it, you need to read it that way because the Mishnah says, v'chein. The same case, which means that even if they consumed it, you still compensate for that. You get the money back. They get reimbursed for that which they ate. Mashalo achlu, whatever they didn't eat, heim yachziru lo et basar. They return him the basar, lo yachziru lehem et adamim, and he refunds them the money. Over here, it's different than the case of Bechor. By Bechor, it's asur ba'ana'ah. So you have to bury the animal. There's nothing to return to him. It's asur ba'ana'ah, and he has to compensate. Over here, the treifa is not a surba hanah, it's a surba achina. So here you give him back the treifa, let him do whatever he wants. He can sell it off, he can feed it to the dogs. And then he reimburses them, he gives them their money back. Machru, the oved kochavim, if they, the people who bought from him, sold it to a non-Jew, or they made into dog food, yishamu deremei treifa. They pay the amount of a treifa, or in essence, they subtract from the monies that they paid him, where they paid him for a kosher animal, they sell it off as a treifa, they deduct that value, and then he has to reimburse them for the remainder of the value that they lost between the price of a kosher animal versus a treifa. That's the way Rashi explains it. You look in the Rabbeinu Gershom, he explains the case, interestingly, a little differently. It says, Machru alokhim, if those purchasers sold the basad ovei kochavim b'yoker, for whatever reason, they were able to fetch a high price from a non-Jew for this meat. So they actually got more value than you would have expected. Oh, itilu lokhavim, for the gift to the dogs, v'adayin lo nanu atadamim. And they have yet to pay the person who sold them the animal, yishamu lo dmei treifa, shehi bezol. They pay him whatever a treifa would be worth, the cheap amount. Below yishamulo kol adamim, he won't give him all the money shnatnu mimeno that they got for a profited from it. Vishu machar treifa midato. Here the Rabbeinu Gershom says it explicitly. He sold them a treifa intentionally, and so we're going to penalize him. So even if they in the end end up getting much more money than they should have gotten for a treifa, they got lucky. A goy wanted it. He had a party, whatever it was, that they were able to sell it for a good price. They don't have to reimburse him and give him that money. All they have to do is pay him a treifa, what the cost of a treifa would be, and they keep all the profits because he cheated them. He lied to them. So here in this case, according to Rabbeinu Gershom, you have yet to pay him. And that's why you are the beneficiary. In the case where you've already paid him, that's the way Rashi describes it, then it's about refunding the money and subtracting whatever you garnered for the treifa. So that's the Mishnah. All right, Tanu Banan. Hamukher basar l'chaveiro, someone who sells meat to his friend, v'nimsa basar b'chor, and then afterwards they find out that it was basar b'chor, meaning that they shouldn't have been eating it. Peirot, he sold them peirot, v'nimsa tvalim, and then they find out that we're tumot masrot, we're not taken off if it was tevel. Yayin, v'nimsa yayin esech. So the wine, in the end, it found out that it's wine that was used towards libations about a zarah or something that was a sur. Mashachlu, achlu, v'chzir lehem et adamim. Whatever they ate, they ate. And he has to compensate them for that. B'shima ben Elazar omer, dvarim shanefesh katsa behen, yachzir lehem et adamim. Things that are disgusting, then he has to reimburse them. Shein nefesh katsa behen, inachel lehem et adamim. Things that they're not disgusted by, then you deduct the amount, which means that they got hana. And that hana, he can subtract from the reimbursement because they did get some benefit over here. That benefit he can charge them for, even though this wasn't the way they wanted to go about it. Now, whether there's really a fundamental difference between the Chachamim, Rav Shimon, and Elazar, it's not clear here. Are they arguing in whether it's a knas, or whether it's an issue of, I didn't get hana, like the explanations that we gave before, that could be the difference between them. The Chachamim believe it's a knas, and it applies across the board. Whereas Rav Shimon, and Elazar says that it is a issue that you didn't get hana. You don't get hana when it's something that is disgusting to you. Whereas when it's not disgusting to you, you did get hana from it, so that might be the explanation. Or you could believe that everybody agrees that the issue here is hana'a, or the lack of hana'a, and they're arguing about what people feel about isur. Rabbi Shimon Elazar says there's certain inherent disgusting things that are asur. The other isurim that are exactly that, they're isurim, but they're not inherently disgusting. Whereas the Chachamim say, every isur is katzabem. Anytime a person eats something that they weren't supposed to eat, that's something that's disgusting to them, and that doesn't give them hana'a. So you could explain the machloket in either one of those ways and say that either they are arguing fundamentally about what the reason for the reimbursement when you eat is over here, or they could be agreeing about what the reason is, just they're disagreeing about what is considered to be disgusting or not disgusting in this case. Where it says, according to Rabbi Shimon Elazar, these are the things that people are disgusted by. Nevelot, vitrefot. The assumption here is that nevelot and treifot are not stam nevelo or stam treifa, where like the shechita went wrong, or there was a little problem and it's a treifa. It's more along the lines of a nevelo where the animal died naturally, a treifa where there's some significant issue with the animal, it was attacked by another animal, or there was some significant damage to the animal. Shkatzim viramasim, those are also creepy crawly things which are disgusting. Ve'elun dvarim she'ina nefesh katzabem. And these are things that are not disgusting to people. Bichorot, tivalim, v'yayin nesech. The items that we just mentioned before in the Braita, those aren't disgusting because inherently these items are just fine. There's a metaphysical problem with all of these items. There's no physical problem. The bechor is no different than any other meat that you would have eaten. It just happens to be, it's a bechor. So that's the problem. Tvalim, the produce, there's no difference in the tvalim or not tvalim. It's whether you took off the trumot of masro from it. And same with the yayin nesech. Yayin nesech is yayin. Whether it goes to avodah zarah or not, it's a question of the metaphysical properties. So again, when the metaphysical properties are problematic, that's not nefesh katzaben. And Rashi over here formulates it, yachzir lehem kol adamim. When is it that you give back all the money from Rav Shimon Lazar? The chol mashachlu enu ne'aneh lahem. Everything they eat, they don't get any anah, mishash no dalahem. As soon as they find out what it was that they ate, whether it's retroactive or prospective, there is a problem over here, which is that now when any time they think about it, it causes them pain and not anah. Even though when they ate it, at the moment that they ate it, they got anah, nevertheless, at this point, there's enough detrimental feelings that are associated with it that offsets all that hanah that they got from it when they ate it. And that's why you would reimburse them fully, according to the Chachamim, for all the items of Yisur, from Rabbi Shimon Lazar, for those things that are disgusting. The Gemara says, Bechor Yinache, the Bechor, he gets to deduct what the hanah was that they got from eating. The Gemara says, Belemalei, Mayav Sadetach, what did I cause, or what loss did I cause you? Remember that the Bechor is Asur Bahanah, Benkach or Benkach. So the owner couldn't have done anything with it anyway. So now when those people that bought it from him, when he deceived them and they bought it from him and they ate it, why do they have to pay him for that hana'ah? The owner had nothing to do with this animal. It was asur b'hana'ah. So they're eating of it and getting hana'ah shouldn't be something he's able to deduct from the reimbursement that he has to make to them. So the Gemara says, lo tzricha, kagon dezavin lei mimakom muma. He sold them the piece that had the mum on it. Damar lahu, he can say to them, Ilav da achalt, had you not eaten it, hava makzinale. I could have shown it to the chacham now, bishari niale to Rabbi Yehuda, and he would have been matir it for me retroactively like Rabbi Yehuda. The machlok Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir we saw in the Mishnah. Rabbi Meir says if you see it after the fact, it's never good, it's a surbana. Rabbi Yehuda differentiated between dokin shubahayin, which change, where you can't show it after the fact, versus mumim that are significant physical mumim in the animal, which don't change after death. Those you can even show after death, even though you're not supposed to. But if it happens, b'diavad, you can show it after death and be matirit. So he says, you caused me a loss now because I could have at least gotten the heter of the chacham retroactively. Tvalim, what about Tevo? Why is there any loss called to him? The Tvalim were asurim anyway. And so when they ate them, even if they get hana, they didn't cause him any loss. It says, because hava matkinina luhu, v'achalna luhu. He says, I could have retroactively taken off the trumot and masrot, fixed the problem, and then you wouldn't have been eating tevel. So therefore, when you got enough from it, you should have to reimburse me, according to Rav Shimon Elazar. Yai nesech, ayedei tarovet. Yai nesech is a case of tarovet. The way Rashi explains it over here is not that I could have made it into a tarovet afterwards. I could have mixed it with wine, and then it would have been okay. But rather, it was already mixed together with wine. Where Rashi even states that he intentionally mixed it with wine, which is interesting because generally we're not mevatel yisurim the chatila, but it doesn't sound like this guy is such a good guy to start with. But say he mixed the yayin esech with kosher wine. Then according to the shita of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, you can then sell the wine off minus the part of the wine that is yayin esech. So for instance, if you have 98% wine that is fine, 2% that's yayin esech, in that mixture, we don't say that the yayin esech is a kosher and then makes the whole thing asur. Rather, he says you can sell it off to the goy and just only charge him for 98% of it. Don't charge him for that 2%. That way you're not getting anah for the yayin esech. So here he says, I had a solution to my problem. I could have sold it to a goy and just deducted an amount. Now that you drank it, I can't sell it to him. So there is a loss caused to me. And that's why he can say to them, you got anah. Therefore, I can deduct that from the reimbursement. And that's what he says. Yayin esach edei tarovet, ki Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel. That's not yayin esach shnafal the bor. Yayin esach that fell into the capture mechanism, the place where the pressed grapes, the juices come out and go into the pit. Kulo asur b'ana. If yayin esach goes in there, the whole thing is asur b'ana. Yayin esach is oser bekoshu. Shimon Gamaliel omer, yimkor kulo lovdei kochavim. You can sell the whole thing to Ovdei Kochavim, chutz min yayin nesach shibo, with the exception of the yayin nesach that's in there, so that way you're not getting any hanah from the yayin nesach. You can then save or salvage the the good wine that's in the mixture, because you can sell it off to the goy. So for that reason, when you got hana from it, there was benefit to you and a loss caused to me. If that's the case, it's not zenene v'zelo chaser, it's zenene v'zeh chaser. And therefore, we can then deduct that from the reimbursement according to Rabbi Shimon Elazar, who says when it's not disgusting, there still is hana. According to the Chachamim, you can't make any deductions over here, because anytime it's an isur, either we were kones you, or it's always disgusting. And therefore, it would be full reimbursement in all of these situations. All right, with that, we end the fifth parak. So now the Gemara moves on in the sixth parak to discussing the actual mumim in the Bechor, as to what is a mum that then makes the Bechor either disqualified from going to Mizbech or mutar l'shchita outside of the Mikdash. So we begin here. Al elu mumim shochatim et ha-Bechor. What are the mumim that permit you to shechte Bechor? Nifkema ozno. If there's some sort of cut in the ear, minha. Now, the way that we have it in the Mishnah is chaschus, but you can see here already in the Ot Aleph that many girsot have hasechus, which is, even in the modern Hebrew, means the cartilage of the ear. So if there's a pagam in the cartilage, then that's considered to be a mum that you can check the animal on, because it doesn't heal. Cartilage, once it's torn or broken, doesn't heal anymore. On the other hand, avaloha or, but not in the skin or the softer part of the ear, because that part does heal. So as Rashi explains over here, mumim, where are the mumim? Tnuch ha-ozen. That is the tnuch of the ozen, shekorim tandrin. If you actually look in Rashi and Chumash, in Parshat Mitzora, in Perek Yudalit, Pasuk Yudalit, Rashi over there speaks about the matnot dam and shemen that go in the ear of the Mitzora. It says there, ha-tnuch, tnuch ozen ha-yemanit. On the tnuch of the right ear, Rashi over there says, geder ha-emtza'i. It's the middle line of cartilage that's in the ear. So, according to Rashi, what we're speaking about here with regards to the nifgam haschus, and Rashi calls it the tnuch ha-ozen, means this line. If you look right by the eardrum, the hole to the eardrum, right above it, everybody has this line of cartilage that goes across. That's what Rashi calls the tnuch ha-ozen. Others suggest that that's not what's being spoken about here. Here it says anything that has schus, anything that's cartilage, any part of the upper ear that's hard, that will not heal if it's torn, that is considered to be problematic and a mum that you can shaft on. Other than the ear lobe, that's how Rashi says, lomina or, because it gets better, that is ayaraka, the soft tail of the ear, which is your ear lobe, which if there's a cut or a tear, it does heal up. So in instance, people who pierce their ears, if they don't keep something inside of the pierced hole, eventually the hole seals up and it closes up. So over there, it does heal. So that'll be the difference between those things that do heal and don't heal. And the ones that don't heal, the parts that are on their cartilage, those are mumim that you can check on. Or basar, which do heal, those are considered to be a mum ober. Nizdaka, if it was cracked, apopish lo chasera, even though it's not missing anything. Nikva, if it has a hole in it, melo karshina, the size of a karshina, karshinim, are animal feet. The Mishnah Shvi'it says they're still subject to Shvi'it, even though they're animal feet and not for human consumption, because in difficult times, shatatchak, human beings eat it. So if there is a drought, a famine, they might eat the karshinim, because they are edible. They're just generally used for animal feed and not for human consumption. So here, this malo karshina, which is translated either as vetch, we'll see the Rashi does that later in the Laz, or a horse bean, that is the size of the hole you need in order for it to be considered a mum. So you actually have three different categories of mumim here. You have gam, you have nizdak, and then you have a nekev. And we're going to see that each one of them has their own qualification. Nekev, we saw over here, has a size of a hole of a karshina, because the nekev is smaller and it's found in the center of the ear. In order for it to be a mum, it has to be something of a more significant size. Nifgema or nistika usually happens from the edge of the ear, and therefore they have a lower standard or a lower qualification. In addition, the difference between nifkema and nistaka, nistaka doesn't have to be missing anything because it's something that's cut all the way through from side to side of the cartilage. Nistaka, even without missing, it's a visible mum because of the separation between the sides. Nifkema is where there's a cut into the cartilage, but it doesn't go all the way through. We're going to see later in the Gemara that there is a qualification for what size that has to be. So those are your three different types of mumim and different standards. The nekev, which is the smallest mum, has the highest threshold, which has got to be a hole the size of a karshina. The nifgema, which is the next level, which is cut, but not cut all the way through, that we're going to see is when your nail gets caught in it. That's considered to be a mum. Nizdaka has no shiur, as long as it's torn all the way through, that's enough. Because we're going to see the requirements for a mum are, first of all, something that is permanent, also something that's visible. And so therefore, these are the qualifications over here. It has to be something in a visible area. It has to be something that you can notice. And it has to be something that doesn't heal. And that's what they're describing here. O shi yabsha. Or if the ear dries out. Ezo yabsha. What is something that dried out? Anything that if you then puncture it, it will not bleed. That's an indication that it's dried out because there's no longer any moisture or blood there. Biosi ben Mishulam Omer, Yivesha Shetei Nefrechet. That's be so dry that when you pick it up, it crumbles in your hand. Again, if you think back to the Mishnayot in Sukkah, the Mishnayot there in describing a Lulav Yivesh or an Etrog Yivesha, give the same types of descriptions as to whether it means something that is just dried out or something that crumbles. How far along do you need it to be in order to be considered dried out? How much has to dry out is not clear over here. Does it mean the whole ear has to dry out in order for it to be a problem? Or even sections of the ear that dry out would be a problem as long as they would be the same as what was mentioned above. We saw it back in the Gemara in Chulin that Yavsha, something that is dried out, is the same as chaser, as if it doesn't exist. So if you have yivisha, something that in the ear that is dried out, if it maybe meets the threshold of the items above, maybe it'd be a problem just because of that. Or is this a separate category which just says that if the whole ear is dried out, then that's problematic. So now Gemara says, Amai, how do you know, or what is the way to determine what is considered to be a mum, and what is not considered to be a mum? Gemara says, Piseach viver ktiv. Because it says in the Pasuk exactly what type of mumim are problematic. In Perek Tevav, Parshat Re'eh, in Pasuk Chaf Aleph, it says, Chie bo mum piseach o iver ko mumra lo tizbachenu l'shem lokecha. And that's speaking about a bechor, it's kol ha-bechor. And over there it says that a piseach and an iver. So if there's a loss of eyesight, or there's some problem with its ability to walk, that's a mum. But who says any of the items you mentioned in our Mishnah are considered to be mumim? Where it says, Ktiv Nami, the pasuk there says, Ki Yebo Mum. Not only Piseach Viver, it says, Ki Yebo Mum, which is a generic statement about any mum. Where it says, well, what does that do for you? Ki Yebo Mum is a klal. Piseach Viver is a prat. Klal u prat. Eim bechlal ha-mashe beprat. When you have a klal, a generic or general statement, then a prat, a detailed statement afterwards, we assume the detailed statement afterwards comes to define the statement that was made before. So when it says, which is any mum, then it says, Piseach Oiver defined for you what mum was being spoken about in the previous statement. If that's the case, Piseach Oiver in Midrach Rinalo, then you would be limited once again only to Piseach Oiver and nothing else. No problem. Right afterwards it says, Kol Mum Ra. Afterwards it has another klal, chazar, Vichlau, klal uprat uklau. Now you have a klal, prat uklau, because it says chia b'mum is the klal, piseach oiver is the prat, kol mumra is the klal. Iatadan elakena prat. Then you include things that are similar to the prat. Ma prat mifurash. Pratim that are mentioned there, piseach oiver, the common denominator between them is, mumim shibigalui. They are visible problems. Ve'enan chuzrin. And they do not regenerate, they do not cure themselves. Af kol mumim shibigalui v'enan chuzrin. And that is the definition of the mumim that are going to be poselovir, things that are visible, and things that do not cure, do not regenerate. And that will explain why we have the mumim that we do in our Mishnah. Ve'ema, why don't you say, ma'prat, mifurash, mumim shibigalui. That is something that's a visible mum. Ubotel or butel mimelachto, it cannot do its function anymore. Veinu chozer, and it doesn't regenerate, it doesn't cure itself. So it has two out of the three we mentioned before, but now the third one is that when you have a piseach oliver, it's butel mimelachto. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains butel mimelachto is that it is then bubatel mimelachto. It can no longer do work. Piseach viiver sheinu ra'oi lemelacha. Piseach and iver is no longer ra'oi to do work in the fields, to bring the plow, to carry things. He has a deficit now that makes it that he's no longer functional as a working animal. So that's what butel mimelachto would mean. According to Rashi, I think you could argue that butel mimelachto doesn't mean the entire animal can't work, but that item has lost its function. That when he has iver, then he's lost the function of the eye. There's a problem now that one of the functions of the animal no longer works. If he has a little tear in his ear, the ear still works. He can still hear it through his ear. You haven't stopped the functioning of the ear. Whereas by iver or by piseach, his eye is no longer functional. His leg is no longer functional. So whether it means that the animal as a whole is not functional, or whether that particular limb is no longer functional, that should be part of the definition. If that's the case, then all the items in our Mishnah are lama tznan. Our Mishnah that says, nifga ozno mina chaskus, mina skus, below mina or. So what are you going to do with our Mishnah that includes items that are clearly not butal mimlachto? Yes, they are mumim that are visible. Yes, they're mumim that don't regenerate, but they are not butal mimlachto. So kol mumra ribuyahu. Kol mumra is really a ribuy. Now, the Gemara doesn't make any comment here. It doesn't say the word Ella. The word Ella would have been very helpful here, because that means that whatever we said before we're rejecting, or now we're starting down a new path. Over here, it's not clear that's what the Gemara is doing. It just says, Kol Mumra Ribuyehu. So there are one or two ways you can look at it. It's still a Klal Upratu Klal, but because in the end it says Kol Mumra, it could have just said Mumra. In fact, that says Kol Mumra, there's an extra Ribuy over there, and that's what the Gemara is saying over here. It's a Klal Upratu Klal with an extra Ribuy on it, added on. That's one way to learn it. The other way to learn it is that we're changing the method of limud. There are two methods of limud with regards to klalim and pratim. One is klal upratu klal, which we just discussed. The other one is riboy, miut, riboy. There are two schools of thought about how you darshan the Torah, and maybe that's what the Gemara is doing over here. It's switching from klal upratu klal, where you only have kain a prat, to riboy, miut, riboy, which there you include everything, aside from some items that are excluded by the miutim that are there. One or two items that are excluded by the miutim, but otherwise everything is included. So it's a much stronger form of riboy or inclusionary type of drosha. And maybe that's what the Gemara is saying here. Kol mumra is really a riboy and not a klal upratu klal. Gemara says, yochi, if that's the case, now that you have a riboy, whether it means a riboy within klal upratu klal, or it means a riboy miut to riboy, then mumim should say ternami. Things that are not visible, mumim, you should also include now, because those are items that can be included from the ribuy. It says, alamatznan, we have a Mishnah upcoming, it's something that we saw back on Lamed Hayom and Aleph, chutim achitzonot, the outer, according to Rashi, gums, the gums in the front of the mouth, shenifgimu, that were cut, or shenigmimu, or were filed down, vapnimiot, and the back gums, shenekru, that were taken out, or according to the way Rabbeinu Gershom explained it back then when we read it, chutim achitzonot are the incisors, the teeth in the front, and the pnimiot are the molars in the back. In that case, if the ones in the front, all they require is to be cut or filed down. The back ones, nekru, they have to be taken out completely. Nekru in, nifgimu, nigmimu, lo. They have to be taken or uprooted totally. If they're just damaged, they're not. As we discussed back in Lamed Hay, we're going to discuss when we get to the Mishnah, that's because you need a mum bigalui. So when it's the front teeth, or going to Rashi, the front gums, those are things you see when the animal eats. Those are things you see all the time. The back molars aren't things that are visible. There you need a more significant damage in order for it to be visible. If the molars are taken out entirely, when the animal then bleats or moves, does whatever it does, it opens its mouth, you'll see that all the molars are missing. Gordavashi, you'll see the back gums are missing. So you need something more significant, which means that it has to be bigaloi. So now you're telling me you have a reboy, why don't you include mum shebeseiter? You can't do that. So the Gemara says, v'ina mumra v'leka, you need a mumra, and a mumra, according to Rashi, is bigaloi sheminavlo. Mumra means something that makes it disgusting, something that ruins it, and that's a mumra. So if it's not visible, it's not a mumra. And so in order to be qualified as a mumra, you need to be something that is visible. It says, Iochi, it's not clearly understandable how the Gemara made this leap here, logical leap. If you say, kol mum is a ribuyahu, then Iochi mum over nami. So it sounds like it's not a logical connection to the previous statement of the Gemara about mumra, but rather it goes back to the original kol, which is, if kol is a ribuy, then why don't you also include a mum over, which is a temporary mum, it should also be enough to shochet the animal. Alam atznan, we have a mishnah below minahor, the part that is the soft part of the ear, there you can't shecht on it, because it's a mum over. It's a passing mum, it's something that cures itself. Where it says, mum over svaruhu. The fact that you can't shecht on a mum over is a logical reason. Hashta mifrak lo parkinel ilavei, when it comes to a mum over, you cannot redeem the animal based on that. Mishchat shachtinan ilavei, then you're going to allow us to shecht it? Meaning that the qualification to redeem an animal is, or the threshold to redeem an animal is lower than the threshold to shecht it. So by Tshulam and Kashim, if a mum over is not sufficient to allow you to redeem it, then certainly it's not going to be sufficient to allow you to shecht a bechor. The Tanya, how do we know that it's not enough by Psuleim and Kashim? This week's Parsha, the end of Parshat Bechukotai in Perek Chav Zayin, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Im Kol Be'imat Me'ah, sounds like a non-kosher animal, that you can't put it on the Mizbeach, because it's not kosher, you bring it to the Kohen to assess it, and then you redeem it, and you give the money to Hekdesh. The Gemara says over there, that's not speaking about a non-kosher animal, it's speaking about a Baal Mum. How do I know that? You're saying to me that it's about a Baal Mum that's being redeemed? Maybe it really means a non-kosher animal. Both of them are disqualified from going on the Mizbeach, and you would have to redeem them. How do you know whether the pasuk is speaking about a non-kosher animal, or if it's speaking about a Baal Mum? And according to you, you're speaking about a Baal Mum. How do you know that? Because you omer, that's because the pasuk later on in that Perek Chav Zayin, Pasuk Chav Zayin says, Be'im ba be'im atmeyah. There's another pasuk that talks about the non-kosher animals. So if that's the case, I already have the non-kosher animal covered in Pasuk Chav Zayin. How do I do with the Pasuk Yud Aleph that says, those are animals that have a mum in them that are being redeemed. That get redeemed and the monies go towards purchasing a new korban. You would think that you could redeem them based on a temporary mum. Tamalomar, asher lo yakrivu mimena korban Hashem. Only things that cannot be brought as a korban. Mishein ukreva kol ikar. Only things that cannot be brought, period. There's no chance. There's no opportunity. There never will be an opportunity to bring them because the mum is permanent. Yatzdazo shein ukreva hayom elo lemachar. A mum aver is something that you can't bring it today, but once it heals, you could bring it. Therefore, it's not called asher lo yakrivu mimenu la korban Hashem. Because it is something that you will be able to bring as a korban Hashem. You just need to wait. So you see there, by psula mikdashim, a mum over is not a sufficient threshold to allow you to redeem the animal. If by redemption it's not enough, then certainly to be shecht a bechor, it's not going to be sufficient. So that's the logic argument why mum over is not included in those mumim that let you shecht a bechor. Iba yitema. The other option is, imkein piseach uiver lamali. If that's the case, then why do you need piseach viiver? Now this either could be because of the way that we darshan it as a ribuy miut and ribuy, so the piseach uiver have to come to do something. Because you have a ribuy miut and ribuy, you included everything, you need piseach viiver to exclude something. You took care of mum shibigaloi from mumra. Mumra tells you it's gotta be bigaloi. So the only thing left that is to exclude as a mum that heals itself, or what's otherwise known as a mum over. And when you use riboy and miut to riboy, the miut has to exclude something, and that's what piseach and iver come. You could even suggest now that piseach and iver, you have two miutim, one is the ma'at, mum shebeseter, and one of them comes to exclude the case where it's a mum over, or a mum that cures itself. And that way it would answer both of the questions that we had before, as to why these items are excluded. Mara continues and says, Nizdaka, if it gets a crack of it, afu pishlo chasera, even if it's not missing anything. Tarabanan, hasedek koshu, as we mentioned in the Mishnah, when it's torn all the way through, doesn't matter, any amount is problematic. Habgima, a gam, is bembi de adam, bembi de shemayim. Doesn't matter whether it happened by human involvement, or it happened naturally. Rashi over here translates bidei shemayim, shenavadimo, congenital. So the question is, when Rashi says congenital, does that mean that's only thing that's called bidei shemayim is when it's congenital? But if it happened naturally after it was already born, that's not considered to be bidei shemayim, that's considered to be bidei adam? Or is he teaching you a chiddush? You might have thought when the animal's born with it, that's not called a mom or mom bidei shemayim, because it's always that way. Nothing changed about the animal. And therefore that would not be a mom if it was bidei shamayim. So those are two different ways to learn Rashi. Obviously the nafkamina is, if it happened naturally after it was born, it wasn't congenital, if it happened naturally, is that considered to be bidei shamayim? Or is that considered to be bidei adam? So now, bidei adam or bidei shamayim, michlal, from that you would infer the sedek bidei shamayim lo. That means that according to this, it's only a b'gima that is ben ba'adam ben b'shamayim. But in that sedek, which doesn't have this statement made about it, would only be bidei adam, not bidei shamayim. Gemara says, Ella sedek u'pigima ben bidei shamayim ben bidei adam. You have to amend the brayta to read, not just a pigima is ben bidei adam ben bidei shamayim, but a sedek and a pigima are affected whether it happened naturally, whether it happened by human intervention, they are considered to be mumim. Bikama shior pigima, that's what I noted in the Mishnah, how big does the pigima have to be? Kadesh tachborba tziporen, for a nail to get caught in it. Again, that's the three different sizes that we had. A nekev needs kemelo karshina. Gum needs your fingernail to get caught in it when you run it along there. That's a begima. Again, it's a begima. It's not going all the way through the ear. It's cut into or is lacking on one side. Sedek, which goes all the way through, is a koshu. Any amount, even without kinsaron, is considered to be a mum. Nikva melo karshina. Tan Rabbanan. Kama nikivat ha'ozen. What is the amount of a hole in a ear? Melo karshina. That's what we have in our mission. That's what Tanakama says. Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Yudo omer b'cheradasho. It has to be the size of a lentil. Rashi over here says that a cheradasho is a little smaller than the size of a karshina. A karshina is slightly bigger than an adasho. So Rabbi Yudo is a little more makil over here in terms of the mole. Be'ezuhi yibesha. What's considered to be dried out? Case where if you puncture it or you get a hole in it, it doesn't have any bleeding. Rabbi Yossi ben Meshulam Omer, Yevesha kadei shetei nifrechet. Yevesha is when it crumbles when you grab it or touch it. Tana, krovim divrehim liot shavim. Their positions are almost equal. Divrehim deman. You have two machlokot tanaim in the breita that we just brought. Machloket Tanakama and Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda about the size of a hole. Then you have Machloket Tanakama and Rabbi Yossi ben Meshulam about how dry it needs to be. When the bright at the end says they're very close in their measurements, which of those two Machlokot was it speaking about? Ilema, the Tanakama Rabbi Yossi ben Meshulam. If you say it's the difference between the Tanakama and Rabbi Yossi ben Meshulam about being dried out, Tuvaika, there's a big difference between something being dry where it doesn't bleed, and something crumbling in hand because it's so dry. That's not close together. Elatanakama Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Yehuda. The makloka that is really close in size is that of Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Yehuda and the Tanakama, where Rashi says that a karshina ain't a gdola mi'akadash el ma'at. This vetch or this horse bean is only slightly bigger than the lentil bean. Where it says ki'adash in batzir mi'akadash elo. That if it is the size of an adasha, that is enough. Less than a kanadasha, it is not. So now Gemara says, Viramini, is that really true? Marzeya, when it comes to the piercing of the ear of an Eved Ivri who wants to stay past days, 6 years that he was working until the Yovel, you have to pierce his ear. The instrument which you use is called a marzeya. Ainli ela marzeya. The Torah only specifies you can use a marzeya. Minayin the rabot. How do I know you can use other tools to pierce his ear, including hasol, which is like a prick, basira, which is a thorn, amachat, a needle, vamakdeach, which is a borer, a manual drill, vamachtev, a stylus. How do I know that you can use any one of those items? Tamalomar bilakachto. You'll take it. Kodavash nilkach biad divrei Rabbi Yosi Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yosi Rabbi Yehuda says anything you can take, any tool you can carry and use, that's fine. Rabbi Omer marzeya. Ma marzem yuchad shel matechet. Just like a marzeya, a chisel, or an awl, is only made out of metal. Afko shel matechet. So too, the tool has to be metal. It can't be some of the other items that we mentioned here that are not metallic in nature. The Gemara there in Kiddushin, when it discusses their machloket, says their machloket is exactly about klal uprat uklal, or riboy miot riboy. Which methodology of lima do you use? And that brings you the two different options here. According to Rabbi, only metal tools will suffice. According to Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda, any sharp instrument will be fine to make the hole for the Eved Ivri. Ketani Seifa, and then if you pair that up with the latter part of the Mishnah there, Amar, there has to be some Chachamir, so it's Amar Rabbi Elazar is the alternate Girsa. Amar Rabbi Elazar, Yudan Beribi. Rabbi Elazar says, Yudan Beribi, who's the great one, or the great Talmud Chacham Yudan, Hayah Doresh, mentioned, Kushein Rutz In, when they pierce the ear, Ein Rutzim Ela B'Milat. You can only do the piercing in the ear lobe. The Chachamim Omrim, Ein Eved Ivri Kohen Yirtza, Mivnesh Naseh Baumum. An Eved Ivri, who's a Kohen, you can't pierce his ear because it'll make him into a Baalmum. And part of the requirements of an Eved Ivri are, in the Ovel, v'shav el mishpachto v'el achuzato. He goes back to his original family, his original standing. If you put a mum in the ear of the Kohen, he's not going to be able to go back and serve as a Kohen because now he has a mum. So, you can't pierce his ear. V'im tomar b'milat, yirotzin, if you tell me that you're piercing the ear in the lobe, Heyach, Eved Ivri Kohen, Naseh Baalmum. How does that make it into a Baalmum? Huh? The answer is, in Rutzim, Elam HaGovah Shel Ozen. The answer is that you have to pierce the ear up higher up in the ear in the areas where there is cartilage. And that in itself might be the reason that Rav Yudan says you do it in the Milat, is so that it doesn't create a mum for the Eved Ivri that's a Kohen. And that's why that is the location that he picked. So now, we have a question, although the Gemara never really explained what the question is. Rashi claims that the question is based on Rabbi Yosi and Rabbi Yehuda's position. In our braita that we brought, he says the minimum size to be a mum in the ear is a kadasha. When you have a nekev in the ear, the minimum size is bekadasha, is a lentil bean. Over here, Rabbi Yosi and Rabbi Yehuda is one of the Tanaim. He and Rabbi are arguing about which instruments you can use. And at the end of the Mishnah, there's the Chachamim's position, which says that wherever you're piercing him, it's making it into a mum. The instruments that we mention here are all very sharp instruments that do not leave a hole the size of a kadasha. They leave a very small hole in there, a minute hole. And yet we're saying that that is a mum. So the stira, according to Rashi, is between the two positions of Rabbi Yosi and Rabbi Yehuda. In one case, Rabbi Yosi and Rabbi Yehuda is saying you need a hole the size of a kadasha by the animal. And over here, you're saying that you need a minute hole to postel the Kohen from being a Kohen that can serve in the Mikdash. So how do you reconcile those two things? Amar Rav Chana Bar Katina, Lokasha, that's not a problem. Kan lishchot, kan lifsol. There's a difference between what disqualifies you from being able to work in the Mikdash, when it's no longer something that is considered to be something that is mufchar, the choicest or the best, versus something then that allows you to shech the animal as if there is a permanent mum in there. And as Rashi notes over here, ish mumim harbeva b'chor, sheposlim oto likareva gam mizbeach. There are many mumim in a b'chor that will disqualify it from the mizbeach, ve'im achshirim oto lishachet. But it will not qualify it to go on the mizbeach. And then Rashi brings from the Mishnah later on that there are certain things that disqualify you in the Mikdash, but don't qualify you in the Medina to shecht it. And so the same thing over here. When it's to disqualify the Kohen from working, because it's not in a mubchar, it's something that lacks hidur anymore, that's a small hole that's made in his ear. If you want to shecht the bechor based on that, then you need a significant hole, you need the one the size of a lentil. That was how we reconcile between those two positions of Rabbi Yosi and Rabbi Yehuda. Rav says, my karshina, what is a karshina? It's a very common question in the Bavli, because the Mishnayot are written in Hebrew, and they're in Bavel, and they're trying to figure out what the equivalent item, or what the word is in Bavel. Over here it says, I'm a Rav Shravya, Hinda, karshina is Hinda. And if you look in Rashi, Rashi brings down Hinda, B'loshon Zeh, Yemakirim, That's what the Babylonians recognized or knew the word as. I mean, the Aramaic word for karshinim. Lashonaz vetcha. So it's vetch, which is animal feed or a horse bean. But that's the translation of the word karshina. Vaymine Rav Hoshaya mi Rav Huna Rabo. So now Rav Hoshaya asks Rav Huna Rabo, karshina hanichneset biyotza or karshina omedet. When you say that the hole has to be the size of a karshina, what does that mean? Does that mean that the karshina can fit into the hole? Or does that mean that the karshina can pass through the hole? If it just needs to fit in the hole, that's smaller than if it has to have enough room to get all the way through the hole. That's what Rashi says the question is over here. Others, like the Rambam, seem to indicate that the question here is, can you consolidate holes, or does it have to be a single hole? Meaning, does it have to be a hole that is in one place, that's the size of a karshina? Or is it if the cumulative number of holes equals up to a karshina, that's enough to disqualify you? That's the way the Rambam reads the question. Although, we're going to read the Gemara according to Rashi, though in the end it's a little difficult because there are a number of assumptions in the way that we solve the problem that you could undermine very easily. And that's why it makes it slightly difficult reading, but Rashi's explanation is still the simplest way to understand the Gemara. Amar lo, zolo shamati. I don't know the answer to your question. Kiyotze ba shamati, but I did hear something similar. Ditznan, because we have the Mishnah in Aholot, Hashidra va'gulgolet, when you have the spinal column and the skull, shechisru, that are missing a piece of them. Kama chisaron, how much they need to be missing. The Mishnah in Aholot is speaking about items that are metamei ba'ohel. So generally, bones are not metamei ba'ohel. The metamei etzem is metamei kisaora with maga and masa, but it does not have tumat ohel. The only way you can have tumat ohel is if you have rov binyan, the majority of the skeletal structure, the majority of the number of bones in the skeletal structure, or the skull, or the spine intact, any one of those items is tamei tumat ohel. Those are the exceptions by bones, otherwise the bones are not mitamei bohel. Question is, how much needs to be missing from the skull, or how much needs to be missing from the spine, in order for it no longer to be considered the whole spine or the whole skull? How much needs to be missing from the spinal column in order for it not to be mitamei bo'el? Bechamai omrim, shtei chuliot, two vertebrae. Bechel omrim, chuliachat, one vertebrae is enough in order for it to be disqualified from being mitamei bo'el. So Bechamai is machmir, that until two vertebrae are missing, it's considered to be a whole spinal column. It tells Mekil that if one's missing already, it's not considered to be a full spinal column. Ubegul golet, when it comes to the skull, Bechamai omrim kumalo makdeach, it has to be the size of a drill, a borer. Ve'itelo omrim kadeshi natel menachai v'yamut. If you take that much away from someone who's alive, they would die from that missing part or from that injury. Ve'yotiv rav chista v'kami baile. And Rav Chista, when he heard this Mishnah, he has the following question. Kadeshin tel menachai v'kama. What does that mean? Beit Hillel gives some sort of an amorphous size here. You take it and the person would die. How much do you need to take out of a human being in order for them to die? Amalei Rav Tachlifa bar Avdumei, Hachi Amar Shmuel. The Shmuel says, Kisela, the size of a coin, the Sela. V'itmar, Rav Safra Amar Shmaitita, Marle. Rav Safra says that he was told over in the name of Shmuel to him, Verav Shmuel bar Yehuda amar matnita amarle, that he brought him a braita. So whether it was said over in the name of Shmuel, or whether it was said in the name of a braita, the information about how much you need to take away for in order for the person not to live, the amount or the size was a sela. The simaneich, and the way to remember it is Tanei Rav Shmuel bar Yehuda. We have many braitos in Shas that are brought by Rav Shmuel bar Yehuda. So to over here, Rav Shmuel bar Yehuda is the one that believes that it was a braita that was brought by Rav Tachlifa in order to explain or give an answer to Rav Chista. And now Rav Chista responds to him and says, "In Kain asta divrei Rabbi Shammai v'divrei Beit Hillel echad." You're making the position of Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel be equivalent now, which is that the size of a sela is the same size as a melo makdeach, and he's going to bring a mishnah that supports that idea in a second. So part of the problem in the way that Rashi is explaining the Gemara over here, is that the original question that we brought in the Gemara was about Karshina, which was brought or posed to Rav Huna Rabbo. And then over here, the Mishnah that we brought is being explained by Rav Chisda. So now Rav Chisda is a Talmid of Rav Huna. If that's the case, why would Rav Huna Rabbo be bringing information from Chisda to explain Rav Huna Rabbo? That assumes that Rav Huna Rabbo is the same as the Rav Huna that's the Rebbe of Rav Chisda. So if you don't say that, then it's a little bit less of a problem. It's none. We have a Mishnah in Ohalot that says, Ma'or shalona semide adam. If you have a window that is not man-made, which is that if you have two matzah oil in one house, if there is a hole between the two houses, then the two matzah oil will pass from the one house to the other house. How big a hole do you need in the wall between the houses to allow the two matzah to pass through? So if it's a ma'or shalona semide adam, it's a hole in the wall that was not man-made. Shiro malo egrof gadol. It is the size of a large fist. Vizeu egrofo shal ben batiach or ben avatiach. That is the size of the fist of ben avatiach. And as the Rabbeinu Gershom notes over here, this was the nephew of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. It was his sister's son. And he was the head of the Sikrim in Yerushalayim. He was the head of the zealots in Yerushalayim at the time of the Roman siege of Yerushalayim. He's the one that wanted to fight the Romans and burnt the storehouses so they couldn't survive inside of the city. He later helps Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai escape the city and save Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai and a number of things because he gets him to meet Vespasian while he's sieging the city. So he has some positive and negatives associated with him, but he obviously was here a very large man, extremely large, and that might explain why he was the leader of the zealots, the leader both because of his physical might and prowess, and also the fact that he was part of the family of Yochanan ben Zakkai, that might have given him a certain amount of stature and why he might have been the leader. V'amar Rav Yosef, Yeshno Karosh Gadol Shel Adam. And that fist, this Ben Avtiach's fist, which is huge, is like the size of a large head of a person. Na'aseh bidei Adam, if it was a man-made hole between the houses, then Shiro K'mlo Makdeach Gadol Shel Ishka. It's the size of the large drill of the Lishka. The Lishka is the treasury. People that are responsible for the Bedek HaBayit by Ekdesh, they take care of all the repairs and all the needs of the Mikdash. So it's the drill of the Lishka. So this hole that is man-made, Malomak Dekadosha Lishka, Sheuk Pindion HaItalki, is equivalent to the Italian Pudion, because Sela Nironit is the Sela of Nero. And Vieshno Kamalo Nekev Shel Or. And it's the same as the hole they make in the yoke of the animal to tie the reins or the straps into. So here you have four different measurements that they're equating to be the same size. Obviously, it's because people are found in different places, in different professions. This way, if you say they're all the same size, somebody has one of these items to be able to tell what the size is. When it's man-made, you have a smaller requirement because it's intentionally placed there. So because it's intentionally placed there, there's more likelihood that you want it there, and therefore a smaller hole is significant. If it happens by itself, it's a hole in the wall, it's only significant once it reaches a bigger size. But what you have here, and the problem that he's pointing out, is that Melo Makdeach Gadol Shel Ishka is equated to Selai Nironit. That means that Beit Shammai's position of Melo Makdeach and Beit Yavzel's position that now you explain as a Sela are exactly the same. It's a Sela, Melo Makdeach. The easy way to undo that, or to dismiss that, is to say that here it says Melo Makdeach Shalishka, Beit Shammai just said Melo Makdeach. Who says it's the same thing? Or it says here Sela Nironit. It's the Nero Sela. Who says Nero Sela is the same as a Stam Sela? Maybe they're different sizes. We'll see that in tomorrow's daf, that there are other that deal with this in a different way. Nevertheless, Rav Chisda's point is that he's asked the question, he got an answer about a Sela, and then he responds and says, well, if it's a Sela, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are saying the same thing. Ishtik Rav Tachlifa Bar Udume was silenced by this question of Rav Chisda that he had now posed based on the information that Rav Tachlifa Bar Udume brought to say that Beit Hillel's position was Kasela. Ba'amale Rav Chisda. Now Rav Chisda answers on behalf of Rav Tachlifa. Shema Makdeach V'chitzumo Shaninu. Maybe we're talking about a drill and the space around it. If the drill fits exactly in, then the sides, chisumo, is still there. If you move the drill around when it's going in, it It's true today, even with power drills, that if you just drill straight through, it just clears a hole the size of the bit. If you move the drill up and down a little bit, it clears a hole that's bigger than the drill bit itself. It's the same thing with the manual drill or the borer. If you just bore in, you'll get a hole. If you bore in and then you move it up and down a little bit, you'll get a larger area, which gives extra space so that it's not just the size of the bit, it's the size of the bit plus. And so what Rav Chisda is suggesting is that maybe when Beit Shammai said, Malo Makdeach, they meant Makdeach v'chisumo. They meant the Makdeach plus the area around it. A Sela is equal to a Makdeach, but that's exactly a Makdeach. It's not equal to a Makdeach v'chisumo. And then that way you could have a small difference between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, which is Beit Shammai says it's Malo Makdeach plus an area around it, whereas Beit Hillel says it's a Sela, which is equivalent to a Malo Makdeach, but that's without the area around it. And that'll be the difference between them. Bamalei Rav Taklifa says back, Lo Teima Shema, don't say maybe, Ela Vadai Makdeach v'chisumo. That's for sure the difference between them. V'tzarich La'lot Alel. And you can rely on this. What I said is definitely true. Kechizkia Avi Kesh. Like that statement of Kechizkia Avi Kesh, which has some problem with it, and then someone gives an explanation for it, and just like that explanation is really the way to deal with it, so too, this is the explanation to deal with what we heard from Shmuel, what we heard from the Braita, that Beit Hillel's position is a Sela. If that's the case, then a Sela equals a Malo Makdeach. The answer, the way to deal with it, is to say that it's not really Malo Makdeach, it's Malo Makdeach v'chisumo, the extra space around it. And so we're not going to do it now, but tomorrow, Staff will deal with what exactly that story with Chizkia v'Ikesh was, as well as other ways to deal with the question that we have here. But then, what Rav Huna Rabba was answering over here is, I don't have an answer about Karshina, but I have another place where I have an answer, where Kamalo Makdeach doesn't just mean the Makdeach, it means Makdeach plus. So maybe over here too, Malo Karshina means the Karshina plus around it, and then that would answer your question. It's not just enough for it to get in, it's enough to get in easily, in and out easily, meaning that there's extra space around it, and that would be the answer to your question. And if you think that the question here is whether it has to be exactly the shape of a Karshina, or any shape would be okay, or whether multiple holes could be added together, then the answer to those questions would be brought not from the statements of Rav Chisda at the end, but rather from the Mishnah and Olot. And Rav Chisda's whole statement over here is totally independent and just as an explanation. But that which is done by the Shidra and the Gulgolet, when you say Malo Makdeach, it shows you that the shape doesn't matter. And it also shows you that if it's dispersed in different places, as we saw in the Gemara in Chulin, then it doesn't matter. It also can be cumulatively added together. And that would be then the answer to the question about Malo Karshina. Okay, we're going to stop here, five lines down on the top of Lamed Chet Amud Aleph.